Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rick Recking, a member of the Program Committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inability. On Sunday mornings, Prairie provides a wide variety of services. They're presented either by our minister, Sandra Ingham, another member of the congregation itself, or from someone from the wider community, as we are this morning. Well, opening words will be read by Deesa Pence.
One of the interesting things about religions is that they are founded on a spiritual or mystical experience of some leader at some point who has direct contact with the divinity, whether it's Moses or whoever started Scientology. And in the history of religion, you have these upwellings of people wanting to have their own direct experience of God and not going through proper channels. There are very few religions that will support that because essentially the hierarchy falls apart if everyone can have their own direct contact with God. From Michael Pollan.
Our chalice lighting is going to be led by the small family. Jeremy says that either Aiden or Arlen will light the chalice, and I'm wondering who it will be.
In a world filled with darkness of ignorance, let us bring the light of reason. In a world filled with the darkness of despair, may we share the light of hope. In a world filled with the darkness of hate, let us shine the light of love. By Douglas John Traversa.
Today's one of those days when we have an outside speaker, a member of our community, who's come to tell us about the Usonia Institute. This is Bill Linton. Bill is, let me read the first paragraph and then we'll stop there. Inspired by the meaningful impact that a psilocybin study had on a friend suffering from cancer, Bill Linton, along with Malin Utzinger, MD, co-founded the Usona Institute in 2014. He's currently Usona's co-executive director and president and board of directors. Linton also founded Promega Corporation in 1978 and has served continuously as its president and chief executive officer. A global life science research company, Promega employs over 1,400 worldwide and serves scientists in several markets, including human therapeutics, diagnostics, human identity, agriculture, and environmental testing, among others. Please welcome Bill.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and for Penny, who's here, in helping to arrange this. I think my goal here, and along with Malin, and then some wrap-up comments by Tor Patterson, is really to give you a bit of an overview of a very interesting project that we have underway. I also realize that Promega being only 3 miles away, this is my first time here. And so if nothing else comes out of this, I will have had this time in this introduction to this wonderful community here. So thank you very much for the invitation to be here. This is really very special for me. Yesterday was Promega's 40th anniversary, 40 years, and about 38 years in this community just over in Fitchburg. Johan Bjorksten was the founder of Bjorksten Research Labs, and then I moved into a very small building there in January of 1980. But I'm really here to talk about a medical research organization that was formed 4 years ago. It's called the Usona Institute. It's a special category of a charitable organization, 501c3, and it's special because it is affiliated with a publicly owned nonprofit hospital. That's the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics. And we have a very special mission, and I'm going to read to you the mission. To some degree, we're going to go kind of from backwards to forwards. We're going to give you some high-level information, and then you're going to hear more towards the end about how did this thing come into being? How did it happen that 4 years ago this got started? But our mission is that we conduct and support preclinical and clinical research that furthers the understanding of the therapeutic effects of psilocybin. Now, psilocybin is the active molecule in a fungus that some of you may know as magic mushrooms. We also are looking at some other consciousness-changing and sometimes expanding medicines. And our focus on these, because we need to have, what is it that we're trying to do with this? We're focused on alleviating depression and anxiety in people for whom there really are no other good treatments. And as someone said just a couple of days ago, one of our hopes as well is that people not only can live a good life, but they can have a good death. And I'll come back to that story of how I got into this a little bit later on about how I saw and observed somebody go from a very difficult transition in their life to just a beautiful transition. We're the only nonprofit that is focused entirely on bringing these novel serotonin-like molecules through the FDA approval process. Serotonin is this normal transmitter, this neurotransmitter that we have in our brain. And there are a class of molecules, a family of molecules, very, very similar to our normal natural serotonin. But they have some very profound effects. And we think of course, serotonin as being, well, that's normal, that's natural, and the way that we interpret the world is that's kind of reality. But in fact, when you make small changes, we can also see the world in some slightly different ways, and often we see characteristics of ourselves in ways that can really open us up to new possibilities. We have a commitment to open science. This means that when we discover something, we want to make it available to the world. Being a nonprofit, we're not interested in patenting and controlling information. We really want to make this available to the global community. And we've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years developing manufacturing processes for this molecule. We've spent many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars doing this. And for the next 5 years, we're making this available for research, clinical research, basic research, at no cost to any qualified laboratory anywhere in the world. Lauren.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for welcoming us here today, and thank you to Bill for having me share this story. My name is Malin Utzinger, and I'm the co-founder with Bill of USONA Institute. And, you know, I was thinking today as I was listening to the first readings and feeling what it felt like to be welcomed coming in through the door, that the reason we do what we do at USONA, which is really focused on, as Bill said, finding ways to help people through the difficult path of major depression, sometimes treatment-resistant depression, is that when you do that, people come alive and are better able to share, are better able to care for who they are, better able to give from their essential self in a community like this. So when Penny was reading the Desmond Tutu's book and God's Dream, I was thinking, yeah, God's Dream is kind of why we want to be able to find out if psilocybin can be safely given in the way we are intending to give it, as a one-time treatment for people with depression that makes a profound effect for months, sometimes years. Sometimes that one single dose is a lifetime change for these people. So really quite amazing. I came to this as a physician. My background is in family medicine and integrative medicine, and a bit of a research fellowship with preventive oncology. So I too had been interested in the suffering that happens when people get cancer and become afraid about the burden of that. And when Bill and I met, I knew he had interest in funding this research through a nonprofit. And so something happened in that breakfast meeting that we had 5 years ago, and something got catalyzed, and the idea and the work to form this institution began to happen. So let's see. Let me tell you just a little bit about our current project, a little bit more, and then I'm going to pass the floor back to Bill to kind of tell you about the early research that laid the ground for this. So the work, our current project within USONA, beyond synthesizing, purifying, and making the psilocybin available itself for free for 5 years, is that we intend and we're planning right now a phase two study followed by a phase three study that would have to be approved by the FDA. What that means is whenever any organization is trying to get FDA approval for something, you have to do very little studies first that look at safety, sometimes in animals, some are in humans. That's called a phase zero or a phase one. Then you move to phase two studies, which are a little bigger. They're in humans most of the time and studying something specific. Bill will be telling you a little bit more about those phase two with our partnering organizations. And then we, USONA, are picking up by doing a little bit larger multi-center phase two, in other words, involving 5 to 7 different universities and private organizations around the country, possibly one day in Europe as well, to test this out. And if we get good results, excellent safety, like we predict we will, we'll move on and complete the final larger trial that would need to happen. That's the phase three. So, and we'll be taking people who have severe depression, people who qualify for major depressive disorder. Some of them will also have anxiety along with it, but they will come in as adults, ages 21 to 65 for these first studies. And we'll give them a single dose along with an extensive psychological, psycho-spiritually even, I would say, support protocol to help them integrate this profound experience that can happen when one takes psilocybin. It truly does alter one's consciousness for a number of hours, and that's something that we feel strongly should happen in a clinically supervised space, but one that feels warm and welcoming with two kind guides, clinically trained facilitators that would sit with this person and let them have this experience, which sometimes is beautiful. Sometimes people feel that they have sensed more oneness with themselves and the universe and God than they ever had. Sometimes people have to confront very difficult things, past losses, difficult decisions. And as frightening as that may be, people report to us that even the frightening experiences produce a profound self-understanding and kind of a reset button that happens within them that clears them to start anew. So with that high-level description, let me pass it back to Bill.
Thanks, Mom. We also want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions at the end. So if you have questions, then hold them for a minute, but start thinking about them. So where did this idea come from? It was in 1955 that there was an investment banker from New York. He had married a Russian woman, and of course, as you know, a lot of Russians and people from that part of the world they love mushrooms. They go out sometimes every Sunday with their baskets, and they're really experts in terms of picking mushrooms, primarily for soups and, you know, scrambled eggs and everything else. And so with his wife, they would kind of explore and follow up on ethnic uses. And in particular, they had heard about a group in Mexico called the Mazatec. And that's kind of in the southwestern part of Mexico. And so they went there, and it took them 2 or 3 tries to actually get accepted into this very small community. And they were invited at some point to actually participate in this mushroom ceremony that these natives were using on occasion, principally for healing and for divination, really for those two purposes. The woman that introduced him into this, her name was Marina Sabinas. That's a very famous name in this area of research. And in 1957, this report of his experience in this small community was published in Life magazine. And I'm fortunate to have a copy of that, but it's the first time ever that it was reported in Western civilization. But it turns out that the use of these mushrooms actually goes back thousands of years ago, and there are even mushroom stones and certain icons and other artifacts that have been discovered that go back as far as 2 or 3,000 BC, so really a long time ago, and this is really part of a very long tradition. Well, he didn't know what was in them, so he sent samples to a gentleman by the name of Dr. Albert Hoffman, and I don't know if anybody knows that name, but he was a chemist working for Sandoz in Basel, Switzerland, and he had he had synthesized for the first time ever a compound by the name of LSD, and that was in the late 30s, but he resynthesized it in 1942 just because he had this feeling that it was an important molecule, and of course we all know a bit of the history of that, but he was a very well-known chemist. So Gordon sent a sample to Albert. Albert isolated and characterized and did the first synthesis ever of this active molecule, and that was in 1958, published in 1959. This molecule, again, acts very similar to serotonin, a neuroreceptor. It is phenomenally safe. It is non-addictive. Physiologically, on a weight basis, it's 200 times safer than aspirin, which is pretty remarkable. In the 50s and 60s, there were literally hundreds of studies done with this across quite a population, people with addiction, people with depression. But then in the late 60s and early 70s, this molecule, together with many, many others, were classified as Schedule 1, which means that they had no medical purpose, they were highly addictive, the abuse potential was large, and so all the research stopped. And many of those research studies were discarded and thrown away because people were concerned that it may taint the reputation of these universities in which this work was done, which was really unfortunate. So we lost a vast body of information. But then in mid-2000s, around 2006, there was a researcher at Johns Hopkins, Roland Griffiths, who decided that he wanted to possibly explore this. He had worked on drugs of addiction and drugs of abuse, but he got tired of working in that population. He decided he wanted to try something different. And he began to see remarkable results when he used this in populations that were suffering from anxiety and depression. His first major study was on healthy adults just to determine the safety. And it turned out that this had very long lasting effects, even though the molecule itself was out of the body within hours. But the effects would sometimes last days, weeks, and months. And the primary effect was it brought people to a greater awareness of themselves and a greater sense of openness. And you know, as I read many of the principles of this congregation, a lot of what we're looking for in society is to be more open, to be more accepting. And that was one of the principal outcomes of his work with these healthy adult normals. And then there were some additional studies that occurred at UCLA, and then New York University began to pick this up, as well as the University of Zurich. So it just began in a very small way at one university, and then it began to grow. And when I began to get involved in this work about 8 or 9 years ago, there were still just a handful of researchers in the world that were working with this. But I saw some results, and I saw some experiences that I thought were really profound, and I'll get back to that in a minute.
So picking up right there, we really look to those early researchers at Johns Hopkins. There was a group also at NYU and a group out of UCLA who put together these research programs at the phase 2 level where they took people with cancer and people who had anxiety, existential distress, the sense of heaviness that one has when you have to look at the questions of leaving your loved ones, changing your life if you have a life-threatening cancer diagnosis. And together, through those institutions, they studied, let's see, Johns Hopkins and NYU together were about 93 people, and UCLA had about 12 more. They all studied these groups with a single dose of psilocybin and found just dramatic changes afterwards. If you take the typical size of an antidepressant and measure that, the size of the lifting of the depression and the lifting of anxiety was about 3 times greater than that of a typical antidepressant. But better than that, we even saw things like people, about 75% of the people, after having that one dose plus the psychological support for 6 to 8 hours, started to make positive behavioral changes in their lives that were sustainable. They picked up a reflective practice like mindfulness or centering prayer. They found a way to connect better to their families or communities. Some of them started exercising more, taking better care of themselves. Remarkable. You know, that's the best thing you could hope for with any kind of medicine. So we felt so encouraged from that and wanted to build on it. And I think it's of note to mention, especially in a place like this, that one of Roland Griffith's studies at Johns Hopkins, by the way, this has been repeated at approximately the same level of strength in every one of the studies since, 94% of the participants in his study found their one experience with psilocybin and the psychological support they got to be in the top 5 most meaningful spiritual experiences of their lives. Right up there with having a baby, witnessing an amazing act of love out in the community. So again, kind of remarkable things came from this. We also thought it's important to speak just to a moment about how these things work. We know that they work, as Bill said, at serotonin receptors. That's pretty well understood. We also know that they seem to change usual pathways of communication inside the brain and temporarily open them up so that many more parts of the brain are communicating together. And when that stops, as they do, as the medicine goes out of your body, there just seems to be a clearing. It's like people put together the stories of their lives minus some of the painful parts that had stopped them before. They report greater courage to address things that were hard for them to address before, greater kindness. And so there's been a questionnaire that's been given to these study participants right from the beginning that measures something called their mystical experience. How strong, if at all, was their mystical experience? And we find that people who had the strongest reports of a mystical experience, which could be blissful, could be frightening, or both, but it had mystical qualities nonetheless, which include things like having a sense of the sacred, having a sense that the world is one, that I am part of this one world, having a feeling that I myself am whole and coherent and not broken in a way that stops me, broken in a way maybe that opens me and connects me. People also express a sense of paradoxicality or ineffability. They tell you it was amazingly important, and I can't tell you why. It's beyond words. It's beyond something I could say except maybe in poetry and song. So it's really quite amazing, these things. And people who have these strong mystical experiences report the long-lasting antidepressant, anti-anxiety effects. So it's something we want. It's also why we feel it should be clinically supervised with people who understand that experience, because too often if a person goes off by themselves and has this experience, it can be overwhelming and shattering if it happens perhaps recreationally without preparation about what it might mean. Some people have the ability to work with it and understand it and be transformed even if they did go off and do it by themselves, but that's not our recommendation. Ours, in fact, our requirement, if these studies are completed and FDA approves them, it will be to do it in this guided, supported setting where you can process what happened to you. So is that? Yeah. So those studies broke the ground for us at USONA. And another study, just to mention, because it happened right here in our backyard at the UW, they did the first safety study here, supported directly by Bill before USONA was even born. But they tested the material in the liver, the kidneys, saw how it was metabolized, and we got the first indications that it would be safe across a range of doses for people.
I also mentioned in the pharmacokinetic study, we had 12 healthy adult normals. Each of them, and we were taking blood samples, urine samples, so there was a lot of physiological measurements, measurements of the heart as this was going on. It was about a 4 to 6 hour experience. And they had escalating doses, so kind of a small, medium, and larger dose. And 10 out of the 12, after the study was done, asked us if there was any possibility to have a fourth session. Unfortunately, no. Most of us get involved in things that it could be philanthropic, it could be community support, because something has touched us. There's something that has come across our experiences that has been really personal, and that's really how I got involved with this. I think most of us know at some point in our life someone who suffers from anxiety, someone who has deep depression. I have a brother who lives about a mile and a half from here. He looks like Methuselah. He never comes out of his apartment except about once a week when I take him shopping for food, as I did this morning, and then I bring him back. He's gone for 2 walks around the block twice in 3 years. You know, he's just suffering from, it's almost like a terminal depression. But my experience and how I came across this was quite a bit different, and it really goes back 10 years ago when I had a neighbor, close friends with my family. In fact, this woman, Betty Peterson, was the godmother of my oldest son. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had surgery, chemotherapy, and it went into remission for 2 years, then it came back, and she then went in for some experimental treatments at the university. And finally, after a couple of years, her oncologist said, Betty, you're not healthy enough to have any more experimental treatments. We really have to call this and just say, you know, you need to look at the next few months of your life and really make the best of it. And from that point, she had had a lot of hope up until that point. And then she really went into a very deep anxiety state, depression. There was some anger. There was like, you know, why me, oh Lord, you know. And often, as someone, you know, faces that prospect of death within a few weeks or months, it's a very typical response that people have. And she really became clinically depressed. And being friend of this family, I could see the impact that this was having, not just on her, but on her husband, on her children, on her grandchildren, where she would wake up every day with a sense of kind of doom and gloom and this cloud hanging over her, realizing that she only had a few days left or a few months left. So I realized there wasn't going to be a cure for her cancer, but was there the possibility of doing something for this state of mind? And so I began to look around, and I came across a publication of an article that had been written about the study being done at Johns Hopkins by Professor Roland Griffiths. And I called him on the phone, and then I decided to go out and see for myself what was going on there in Baltimore. And I went out there for a day, and he introduced me to the staff. I saw videos of people that had been treated, and they were allowing people into this limited clinical study if they had a diagnosis of terminal cancer with depression. And so I said, well, I think I know someone who might qualify. Betty, 2 months later, was enrolled in the study. She went on a Tuesday afternoon. She had the treatment during the day on Wednesday, and she stayed another half day on Thursday, and then she came back to Madison. And she lived another 4 months. But the miracle, just for that one treatment, for that one day of treatment, was that her depression had lifted. The impact was not only, again, on her, but there was a tremendous ripple effect on her family, on her friends, on her children and grandchildren. Because when she awakened each day now, instead of the sense of doom and gloom and just, you know, yet another day that she had to face with her facing death, she looked at a day as a gift. She saw the possibilities of being alive, even if it's for one more day. And a sense of gratitude. And I just thought, what a remarkable outcome. And so I began to study this. I began to meet the researchers. Then I joined the board of a nonprofit called the Hefter Research Institute. And through that institute, I began funding some of these studies. So that was really the beginning. But at some point, I also realized that there was not really a structure or an entity to begin to take these research results to the FDA and go through that very long and expensive process of getting a therapy approved by the FDA. And so that was really the origin of USONA 4 years ago, and where it is today. It's really a remarkable organization with 13 full-time employees and many, many more consultants and other organizations to help to support the research that we're doing, and housed 3 miles away. So it's really exciting. We have many collaborators, including the University of Wisconsin, Hopkins, New York University, Zurich. The number is really growing now. I wouldn't say the research is mushrooming, but it is.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness, it really is. Yeah, so when we look back, that meeting happened for us in the beginning of 2013. By 2014, we had filed the paperwork to become a nonprofit. And by 2016, we were busy enough and really realized, my goodness, this project of starting to talk to the FDA is not small and not simple, it's complex. And so we were able to hire the first employee beyond Bill's and my efforts, I think, in 2016. By 2017, we had 10 employees. We're just about by the end of the year to hire our 13th. So we're growing. We've developed a network of experts in helping us talk to the FDA. We've built 2 little chemistry labs, just one locally, one in California, to help us better understand the synthesis and the various chemical routes that way. And we've had 1 in-person meeting with the FDA. Sometimes the FDA says to you when you request a meeting, they say, yes, we grant your meeting request and it shall happen by email. Oh, all right, we're having an email meeting now. But we've had many of those. Our first in-person meeting was such a positive surprise to us. We did not know if the FDA would be open to this, completely opposed to this, confused by this. We thought probably the FDA had never really been presented with something that wasn't just a drug, a chemical, but rather we were saying this drug has to go along with this psycho-spiritual support protocol or it won't have the effects we want it to have. We thought, what is the FDA going to do with that? Well, in fact, the FDA looked at our proposal, which we had originally brought to say that we would like to study anxiety and depression in people with cancer. And the FDA said, as public servants, we view it as our duty to bring this medicine, if you show it to be effective, to the widest number of people possible. Therefore, we require, or we strongly suggest, that you make your first study in all of depression, not just people with cancer and depression. They said to us, there are common characteristics across all those kinds of depression and we want you to widen it out. And so that was stunning, stunning to us. But then the real work began. You know, then you put in your next proposal and it's 100 back and forths about adjusting it and getting it right. But that's the way it needs to be. The FDA has a high burden also to, if they approve this, to make sure they feel that it's safe. So we're in that process. We're about to have another important meeting with them in October. From there, we will initiate the plan to actually get started with this phase 2 study in 2019. And then with the results of that, we'll use that to, if necessary, make any small modifications to a phase 3 study that that in our planned timeline could begin about 2021, we think. So it's a long process, but a worthy one. So I think maybe with that, well, I'll open it up to questions, and maybe just to seed that, also to let you know, currently, and just having been finished, there are other studies with psilocybin happening, testing whether it works for people who have addictions to things like smoking, opioid addictions, alcohol. So far, the results of all of those studies are remarkable. So,
I thought also, maybe Tor, why don't you come up?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I'd like to introduce Tor Patterson. She's our Director of Strategic Relations. And she's really the person that is managing a lot of the contacts, the communications that come into USONA. But anyway, I just wanted to mention, Penny, you want to say something?
Well, sure. Well, I'll just say that and then we'll open it for questions. We do really recognize that what we're taking on is something very significant and potentially transformational. And you started today with a quote from Michael Pollan, a famous author, that has really picked up on what's happening here and what the potential is to change our society and our attitudes about medicine and plant medicines like the psilocybin that we're working with. And I think it's really important to recognize that this tipping point, you know, has great potential, but we also come back to our interdependence and each of our roles and our role in this community, all of us are involved as a nonprofit and your community as a nonprofit. So if there are ways you'd like to become directly engaged, you know, I can leave you with our brochure. We have a newsletter, we have informational events, we have ways of engaging individuals who may want to play a more meaningful role in this. We're accessible and available. I'll be here afterward, so feel free to contact me.
There have been, the UW studied multiple doses up to what would be considered staggering doses. We have found that while there is, there seems to be a cumulative growth effect by repeated doses at various levels, the optimal dose response seems to be at about 25 milligrams across a variety of weights. It's very interesting. You would sometimes think a little tiny person might need a tiny amount and a big person might need a larger amount. And the pharmacokinetics study seems to suggest it's not the way this works. It must have something to do more with people's receptor density and so on. So our study, every well-controlled study that has been done recently in the United States looking at this had been done on a weight-related dose. But after all those data were looked at and we did our own pharmacokinetics study, we decided that USONA would commit to a 25 milligram dose for everyone and keep it there. Let's see, you had a second
just
part.
Just a comment about the placebo.
Placebo, yes. So some of the earlier studies, they've been very interesting with how they tried to do this. At NYU, they used a placebo of niacin to try to see what would happen compared to. One person actually, for those of you who don't know, niacin is one of the B vitamins, doesn't have any psychological effects. One person in that study of 23 people had a full-blown mystical experience on niacin. So the protocol does something, you know, the psychological support that comes along with it most definitively. But it was just one person who had the full-blown mystical experience on niacin. Our study, we will be having an arm that gets an active placebo, which we aren't announcing yet due to the FDA still needing to review it, but there will be a placebo pill taken, and those people will get just the rest of the psychological, spiritual support compared to getting both. It will be definitely a multi-center trial, at least 5, possibly to 7 sites. And the UW is, we are in the process of looking at UW as one of those sites, but none of the contracts have been finalized yet with the various sites, so we cannot say definitively yet. The protocol is fairly complex to be screened in or out. It's a a lengthy process of being asked questions to see if you would qualify, and then even having an initial in-person meeting. But we would absolutely encourage you either to follow up directly with Tura, or if you go to our website, we now have a process in place for anyone who's interested to sign up and let us know that you'd like to be contacted, be screened to be in, or someone you know would like to be contacted.
And I'll just mention, if you don't want to pick up a brochure, our website is pretty simple. It's www.usonainstitute.org.
You know, we do our utmost to try to help people discriminate the way psilocybin appears to act versus other drugs of abuse because of psilocybin's long use in human history. There have been countless anecdotal capturing of anecdotal data, but goodness, there have been now thousands of human beings also studied, if you look at Europe and the United States, with just so far quite remarkable safety showing up, certainly physiologically. We aren't seeing signals of addictive, repeated use, seeking use, dependent states from it at all. But you can say this till the cows come home, and if a person has, and understandably as they should, a mindset of concern about drugs of abuse, it can take a great number of hearings of this to begin to shift the idea that it could be safe to study psilocybin. I was someone who came into this thinking, psychedelics to treat opioid dependence, to treat, like, what? You know, I couldn't, but it was, I had to start reading the studies and then had to start talking to the people who had been participants in the studies to actually hear what they were saying about the effects within their lives, because I was one of those people who came in with a slightly negative predisposition against studying psychedelics for this reason. Yeah.
We are very conscious of the fact that there's a lot of media around this as well, and you'll probably note that we are very low profile in terms of that, but what we do is focus on the science and the research. So if you go to our website, or if you want to sign up for a newsletter, we'll be sending out information as new publications come out, scientific research. And that's kind of our method of engaging in this dialogue, as there's, you know, again, media rise around this. And so if it's helpful to you, as you know, if you want to share the word, especially in your profession, we provide links to both current research and directly related to the work that we're doing, but also related research in other areas and other substances as well. So you might find that useful.
To build on what Tura is saying, when Michael Pollan was writing his book, he called us and wanted to talk. And we talked to him for about 45 minutes, and the vast majority of what I had to say to him was, I'm very happy you're writing this book to try to tell the wider story, but please, it's also going to open as many questions, you know, as answers, and USONA wants to speak after the data are in. We don't, so please do not put these things in your book, please. You know, we'll talk to you when our studies are launched and then finished and analyzed. So, yeah. We don't want to assume. So I'm optimistically sharing with you what we've seen so far, but our research team is definitely saying we are not going into this study assuming it's going to work. This is the first time it's been studied truly in a major depression specific category. The prior studies were more of a, since you know this, and like adjustment disorder, there was dysthymia, there were things that we had far fewer people who met the criteria for true major depression and fewer than that for treatment resistant depression. There are reasons why we decided to go major depression and not treatment resistant, but anyway, just to your point, we're trying to be so careful until we can actually say what these data show. So
are we okay with time?
Um, Our director of clinical and translational research is Chuck Raison. He had very much hoped to be here, but he had an important Atlanta-based commitment that he needed to attend, but otherwise you would have met him. He's a wonderful guy who's a psychiatrist on staff at the University of Wisconsin, and also has an appointment in the School of Human Ecology there. He's kind of he's a real big picture guy, interested in all kinds of practices, most of them ancient, for treating depression, because our modern treatments, SSRIs, sort of work about this well and haven't changed in a good long time, or at least across large populations, they work about this well. Certain individuals are better, but Chuck is very excited about if the results come through strong and safe, trying to integrate into mainstream psychiatric communities and better educate. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I apologize for not knowing we were having more than one speaker. Thank you, Tura, Maylin. Okay, good. Memena.
I'm reading the closing words. It's kind of a example of you can stay away from Prairie for a year and you'll never have left. So here I am. I've never been a religious person. I've been a spiritual person since I was about 15, 16, and when I was first introduced to psilocybin, that really opened me up to thinking about the universe in a different way and coming to significant realizations about my connection to something greater than me. Macklemore.
Thank you. Greet your neighbor. Stay for Soup Sunday.